Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is Chris DeMuth. I'm president of AEI. I'll be moderating this session, which is a discussion of the arguments of Lee Harris's new book, The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West. With our usual genius for timing, AEI has scheduled this seminar on the subject, the suicide of reason, just after Columbia University held what it styled a discussion session with a terrorist madman who is delighted to have American blood on him. And whose madness, as Lee Harris will tell us, certainly has a method to it. Lee Harris is that rarest of rare avises in the modern world, an independent freelance intellectual. He's not at a think tank. He's not at a university. He lives on a mountain in Georgia where he writes books. This is his second. His first 3 years ago was Civilization and Its Enemies, which received richly deserved glowing reviews. Frequent essays, for Policy Review, for the Wall Street Journal, for TCS Daily, and we get him to appear and talk with us at AEI seminars whenever we can, and we're delighted that he would be here today to tell us about how he came to the arguments of this book, what the arguments are, and what we ought to do with them. He will make this presentation. After that, we will turn to my colleague Ayaan Hirsi-Ali, who will provide commentary on Lee's book. Then I will give Lee a chance to respond. I'll try to provoke a little discussion up here. Provocation may not be necessary, but I'll just try to moderate the discussion. And we have a very distinguished group of people that have turned up for today, and I will move things to a general discussion as quickly as I can. Lee, thank you for being here. Congratulations on this wonderful book. The floor is yours.
Okay. Let me begin by just saying how I got to this book. It's my road to suicide, perhaps. It began, obviously, on 9/11. And the first thing, I see it as a shock, like an earthquake shock, and a series of aftershocks. The original shock was obviously on 9/11, seeing the Twin Towers collapse. The second shock was obviously on 9/11, seeing the Twin Towers collapse. The second shock was watching Palestinians celebrate the event in the streets. Had there been worldwide mourning throughout the Muslim world, as there was throughout so much of the rest of the world for this horrible event, it would have had a different significance for everybody. But in fact, it was something that was applauded and celebrated immediately. It was the round of apologetics that came forth from Western intellectuals. Noam Chomsky is a famous example. The fourth shock was the quickness with which everyone in the West, many conservative Western intellectuals, said, we know exactly what's happened. This is a Pearl Harbor event. This is the beginning of World War III. I thought this was like a kind of a rush to history, a rush to final judgment that was inappropriate because I wasn't quite sure we did understand what had happened. The final aftershock were the development of conspiracy theories in the United States in which you had people writing books that said essentially that the Twin Towers had been filled with explosives to be detonated on the impact of the jet, and that the tower had been filled with explosives by the Bush administration. This was all a series of disturbances to me that I had to, in some sense, figure out. And I tried to do it as, once again, as an independent thinker, as a person who is just trying to get answers to something that is baffling. I was permitted by Todd Lindbergh at Policy Review to write a piece called Al-Qaeda's Fantasy Ideology, which appeared in August 2002. The date's fairly important because it's less than a year after the attacks. The question I raised in that piece is why had there been no follow-up attacks? That is, if in fact we were dealing with a World War II situation, a Pearl Harbor situation, it seemed to me that they would have taken advantage of the great victory at 9/11 to sow greater terror throughout the United States. In my piece, I actually said, well, why don't they blow up McDonald's, you know, a Big Macs, attack Kmart's? The anthrax scare, which occurred at that time, showed me the enormous power, the terror on the general populace. That is, it scared the shit out of people. It not only did anthrax do it, but even opening a letter with white powder, harmless white powder, was able to set off, you know, alarms that reached CNN. Okay. So I realized at that point that the analogy that we didn't have to be fighting a Clausewitzian-style war, that we were not involved in something, a normal war. Now, today I find this, 5 years later, I find it a very common thing to say, well, we overreacted to 9/11, that the terrorist threat is way exaggerated, and you find it in terms of arguments that say, listen, look how few people have been killed by terrorist acts compared to the people who were killed in World War II. And that's obviously a fairly, you know, 50 million versus, you know, few thousands. Obviously, and if you make that kind of comparison, then you can say, well, this threat is nothing compared to that threat. The problem with that kind of thinking, as I realized 5 years ago, is that if we were fighting a conventional war, and I said that in my first essay, if this were, in fact, a Pearl Harbor attack, if it were a conventional war, if bin Laden had tanks, you know, moving across the Canadian borders and stuff, we could deal with that. We know exactly how to deal with this. We know how to fight wars. We know how to lose wars. We know all about this, about wars. In fact, what I realized at the very beginning is, and I said this in my first essay, 2002, is that what we were dealing with was an ideological epidemic. We were dealing with something absolutely brand new for our mentality and our thinking. The multiplier effect of terrorism, I'm borrowing that phrase from John Maynard Keynes, is fantastic, and the example I will use is one that is quite close and personal to you, is the murder of Theo van Gogh in Holland. Here, it's simply one man died. In terms of a body count, you cannot compare that with any of the great wars. But in terms of the effect it had on the psychology of people, the psychology of fear within the Netherlands was terrific. That is, if I decide to write a book or make a movie or criticize Islam in any way, if I'm living in Holland, I know that could be my fate. Now, to alter a society, to make everyone in the society afraid to say what's on their mind, to take away a freedom that has been historically the foundation of that society, because the Dutch are quite famous for their stubbornness and their insistence on speaking their mind, to take that away from a society through one act, one simple act, is a catastrophic effect. And to start bringing in comparisons with body counts in previous wars against the psychological damage that can be done by one single act of terrorism shows that the people who are making that kind of analysis are just misleading us. Now, the problem here is that you have many people who are conservatives who are talking about what's going on as World War III and World War IV. And once again, it gives us the idea, the reassuring idea, that we are dealing with something familiar, something that we know how to deal with. And essentially, as I thought more and more about it, I began to recognize that this was not the case, that we were dealing with something whose psychological damage and cultural damage could be immense, with very, very little cost to the people doing this. You were mentioning the situation with Iran, is that the Russians today have zillions of nuclear weapons. We assume Russia will not use those weapons out of rational self-interest. None of us stay awake at night debating about whether we need to take out the Russian nuclear, you know, stockpile, because the Russians we think of as rational actors on the world stage. The idea of a couple of bombs in the hands of Iran is a different thing. It's not because if you simply measure the amount of damage the Russians could do to us, well, it's astronomically greater than even one bomb in the hands of terrorists or two bombs in the hands of Iran. So the question is not in terms of conventional, you know, figures in terms of the physical damage that can be done by the enemy. It's in terms of a much subtler kind of damage that could be done to the culture. In my book, Suicide of Reason, I returned to two paradigms that had been created prior to 9/11. One was Fukuyama's End of History, and one was Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. And the argument began to be, well, which one was right? And what I felt was desperately needed was for us to look at both paradigms in a very critical way and say perhaps neither one of these are really helpful to us now. In fact, not only may they not be helpful, they may blind us to what is essential. In Suicide of Reason, I argue, for example, Huntington's basic model in Clash of Civilizations is that we want to avoid clashes of civilizations. Therefore, no society should try to push its values on others. And he's particularly attacking the West when he makes this statement. He's assuming a kind of 19th century world, European system, in which there's a recognized balance of power, where each state has its own borders, its own sovereignty, and they act together to keep one state from getting too big or too powerful. But none of these states have any interest in just throwing over the balance of power, of simply saying, we're just going to take over, you got everybody else here. What we're dealing with in terms of radical Islam are people who claim over and over again, and whether it's fantasy or not is quite irrelevant at this point, but their intention is not simply to grow, to get a bit more powerful than the next guy, but it's really to bring down the entire system, the status quo. Now, in my previous book, Civilization as Enemies, I basically have a neo-Hobbesian argument in which I say that I appeal to everyone, that is to Muslims, to Buddhists, to everyone, with the argument that, you know, you do not want to have ruthless people take over your society, Shanghai, to take it and debilitate it and demoralize it. And I thought this argument was a plausible argument that could be made, that could be universalized, that is, everyone could accept it. As I thought, the difference between that book and this book is my recognition that, well, there are people who actually like being ruthless. Being ruthless is their way of life. Being ruthless is the way they get ahead, the way they get power. So an argument, a universalized argument, like I tried to do in Civilization as Enemies, doesn't appeal to them. They will say, well, listen, ruthlessness is, in fact, our way of getting ahead. You are on top. You have achieved this world in which you guys are happy with this world. You want to protect it. You want to keep that world intact. But we do not like that world. We want a world that is utterly different. So therefore, we are willing to bring down the entire house to achieve that world. It's a bit like Buchanan, the 19th century thinker who argued with Marx. And his position was, listen, we don't want to go through this dialectic of moving from capitalism to socialism. We want to just bring everything down, okay? And I call these people anarchophiles, the people who love anarchy. And they love anarchy because anarchy is the way in which they can break down the established situation, whether it's in one nation or the world, in order for them to take over, okay? Because there's in order for them to take over, okay? Because there's this incredible asymmetry between an established order and those who are ruthless and want to see anarchy. And the asymmetry is this, is that if we have an established order, we do not want to plunge into a situation where we may lose that order. And one of the chapters in Suicide of Reason, I actually kind of defend the people who urged appeasement against the Nazis. And I defend them by saying these were people who did not want to see another great European conflagration. They did not want to see anything like what occurred in World War II. Can we really blame them for saying, let's try everything possible to keep this from taking place? They were trying to defend and preserve an order that was a good and wonderful order, and they therefore did not want to face the challenge of those who didn't care about that order and who wanted a new world order, as Hitler's famous phrase. The problem there is that they're kind of caught in this trap. That is, they don't want to take the actions that are necessary to fight the enemy, the order-hating enemy. Because if they do, they create disorder. And by creating this order, they destroy their own great claim to fame, which is having achieved an established social system. So this is where I came up with the idea of the crash of civilization as opposed to the clash of civilization, is that the people, the anarchy lovers, those who have nothing to lose and everything to gain, have no problem, you know, teasing, baiting, doing whatever they can do to confuse, befuddle the established order, because by confusing and befuddling the established order, it divides that order. One of the things that has struck me, you know, over and over again about 9/11 is that this one act has ended up dividing the West. It has divided the West between, you know, Europe and America during the Iraqi war. It has divided us in the United States between what you were talking about, the idea that a university like Columbia would invite the president of Iran to speak to it in open forum, and one of the assistants said that he would have invited Hitler too, is that they can kind of play us and divide us. And by dividing us, they obviously weaken us. And consequently, the situation is that as we try to use reasonable techniques, as we try to use all the techniques that work when we're dealing with other parties who accept the basic status quo, we're failing to realize that we're dealing with a party that does not like the status quo and is willing to do whatever is necessary to destroy it. That puts us at an immense disadvantage. That is, that the people who are upholding order are always going to be at a disadvantage of those who just don't care about that order and who want to see a new order. And consequently, the theme of my book is much really less the threat of radical Islam than the vulnerability of the modern liberal West. And by liberalism here, let me try to define liberalism in a way that embraces everybody. Is a liberal, in my sense of the word, is anyone who wants to basically say, we'll try to keep the law of the jungle from ruling and taking charge. And my argument is that in the modern West, we've created societies in which this has been done to a remarkable extent. To such a remarkable extent, we have forgotten that the law of the jungle is what happens when the order is removed. Okay? We've seen this in Iraq. The belief in Iraq was that we go in, take out Saddam Hussein, and then everything gets order is removed. Okay? We've seen this in Iraq. The belief in Iraq was that we go in, take out Saddam Hussein, and then everything gets orderly and nice. In fact, when you take out even a bad order like Saddam Hussein's, what happens is you have chaos. The law of the jungle starts reasserting itself. And that's all you need to do to have the law of the jungle reassert itself, is simply take out the order that exists. So when I speak about the crash of civilizations, I'm not talking about, you know, them bombing us or anything. I'm talking about the fact that they will make it more and more difficult for us to keep any kind of pox, any kind of world order. And I think that being just shredded apart. Most of us came up during a period of time called the Pax Americana, in which America played an extremely dominant role in the world. There was, of course, the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union was still playing more or less as a rational actor. But this world is gone, and this world departed on 9/11. And the problem is that we are reluctant to face up to that, because all of us are the beneficiaries of the orderly system that has developed in the West. We are all beneficiaries of it. None of us want to see it go down the drain. Therefore, it's a very natural psychological reaction to say it's not there. It's not as dangerous as some people make it out. The element of denial, I think, is perfectly understandable. That you don't want to see the threat. You want to say things like, well, the threat is overblown, it will go away. I think one of the more unfortunate comparisons that has been made is the comparison of radical Islam with European fascism, with Islamofascism is a very popular phrase. I think this is one of those analogies that once again is deludes us and misleads us. And the reason for that is quite simple. Italian fascism worked only because the parliamentary system of Italy had just become corrupt and unmanageable. The same thing happened in the Weimar Republic. Both movements, the Nazism and Soviet communism, were both movements in which a political party with a very, very rigid agenda took over a society that really didn't f- fall in line with that agenda. Most, for example, most Germans were devout Christians, Catholics, Protestants. Hitler and the Nazi Party was fundamentally atheistic. Hitler did not want the people to know this, and they're generally atheistic. Hitler did not want the people to know this, and this is why he forbade Goebbels to leave the Catholic Church, by the way. He wanted to kind of pretend, but if you read this table talk, he says, after the war, we will deal with this. We will get rid of Christianity in Germany. Soviet communism was an atheistic movement from the very beginning. In both cases, you're dealing with ideological movements, which were transient, ephemeral phenomenons in the long run, that never were able to get deep into the soul of the people. It went against the grain of the people that over which it had control. Goebbels in his diary talks over and over again about how can we get the Germans more Nazified. He didn't feel that, you know, the Germans were just going about in their middle class way. They were not the fanatics he wanted them to be. The problem is that the idea of jihad, which is central to radical Islam, is not a recently developed ideology. There have been attempts to say, well, you know, radical Islam has its roots in European fascism, and there are some basis for saying that among intellectuals, that is, the intellectual figures in radical Islam. But in point of fact, the idea of jihad goes back to the very foundations of Islam. So we're not talking about something that has been imposed by a small clique of people onto a society. We're talking about the revival of one of the most ancient and honorable traditions of jihad that Islam has, namely jihad. And jihad is, in fact, as I argue in my book that about the difference between tribalism and the rational actor, is that Islam began as an artificial tribe. That is, to become Islamic meant you left your tribe and joined this new artificial tribe of Islam. In order to do that, you had to basically turn against your own people. You had to have a new people. And the glue that kept this together was, in fact, this fanatical devotion to the teachings and the way of Islam. The glue that allowed this to work was the idea of jihad. Jihad is if we have an enemy that we're out to conquer, we're going to have a much greater degree of solidarity among ourselves. That is, it's just a fact of human social psychology that if all of us have an enemy that we, if all of us have an enemy that we hate and we have to go after, we're going to feel a much greater group solidarity, group feeling, as Ibn Khaldun called it, than if we all think of ourselves as friends or as associates. So, to some extent, the fanaticism that's generated by the artificial tribe is kind of the essential glue of Islam. It isn't something that is just adventitious. It is there in its very nature. Now, let me go back and try to explain why this is. Let's compare this with Christianity, the origin of Christianity. Christianity, Jesus had no interest in founding a new society, a new polis, a new state. The Roman Empire was there, kind of take care of everything. And besides, he was interested in a completely otherworldly religion. So he was not, his duty was not, okay, we're going to have to figure out some way of existing vis-a-vis our enemies that want to wipe us out. We, in fact, have to prepare the next world. We don't even have to have children. Muhammad was faced with a radically different problem. He was faced with the problem not of creating a new religion, but of creating a new polity, a polity that was able to survive, and a polity that would have to struggle against the worst possible brutality. They had to fight their way to survive. And I think those people who attack Islam because it arose out of this the law of the jungle are being naive, because for Islam to have existed, it had to be able to fight with the weapons of the people around them. So it didn't have the option of being like Christianity. There's a wonderful book by the Egyptian novelist Mahfouz, The Children of the Alley, in which he deals with all the great prophets that have appeared. It's a parable of world history that takes place in this one little village. And the figure of Jesus is basically, he's seen as a perfect man, but he's too good to defend himself against the law of the jungle, against the gangsters who rule. Muhammad is seen, however, as a figure who's able to fight the gangsters with their own weapons. And therefore, Mahfouz, being a good Muslim, says that this is a superior adaptation to the world as it really exists. Thomas Huxley, I quote in my book, has a very interesting comment along the same lines. He says that the golden rule is a very, very wonderful thing, but it doesn't exist very long in a society unless there are some people in that society who are prepared to disobey the golden rule. And I think that's a profound insight. And I think that the tragedy, the great crisis facing the West, and once again I'll quote Ibn Khaldun again, is the concept of forgetfulness, which I used in my earlier book, Civilization's Enemies. We literally have forgotten the law of the jungle. We've forgotten how mankind has evolved. We've forgotten the struggles that it took, you know, for us to obtain any kind of polity like the one we have. And the latter part of Suicide of Reason has been able to be liberal. Was it in fact escaped history? It escaped the law of the jungle. And I quote one of Hegel's remarks, saying that in America, European man was able to start all over again from a fresh start. History was not a nightmare from which we had to awake, to quote James Joyce, in America. It was not there. The Indians could not be enslaved. If we had come to a country in which there was a docile population of Indians who had already been enslaved and taught to till the fields, then we would simply taken over and had them be our slaves. That didn't work here because they either ran off, they fought us, but they wouldn't be our slaves. So America was made up of peasants from the old world who were trying to escape the history of the old world. They came here to a place where they couldn't get anybody to work for them. They had to work for themselves. So it wasn't a matter of an ideological work ethos. They had to do it themselves. They had to farm their own fields. Okay, this meant that we created a society here that was totally, just could not have existed unless there had been a new world, and unless this new world had been populated by people who were naturally hardworking people. The other thing I throw in is that by another fluke of history, is that most of people. came with a very different kind of theory of religion. It's not that they differed from the old world ideologically in their religion, but they wanted a religion in which they controlled the congregations. There was, in fact, Calvinism in the old world had said basically the congregation should control itself. But here, virtually everyone, even the Episcopalians, didn't want to have anybody control them. They picked their own ministers. So here, by the very nature of America, there was no established church even. So people got together and formed their own communities. They went off and split into different sects, and everyone got along together. So the very foundation of our world is this exceptional serendipitous set of circumstances, which will not ever be repeated again. And the concluding, really pessimistic note of my book is that in the same way that Turner and Turner's famous thesis about the end of the frontier is that we may have run out of places without history to move into. The countries that I argue that fought to liberate Europe in World War II were in fact Canada, Australia, and the United States. But these are the bulk of the number of soldiers who came from there was really quite terrific. And the problem is if we succumb to history, if we do not been given this one window of opportunity, and that window may be closing at this point. And if so, that is what I call the crash of civilization. If we're going back in a world in which thugs rule, in which the ruthlessness is what gets you ahead, then bye bye to everything that we have found sacred and important in our society, in our lives, and every value we found sacred and important in our society, in our lives, and every value we take for granted. At the very end of the book, in the conclusion, I try to reassert a bit of optimism, and I argue that since I'm really horrified at the partisan insanity that is going on in the United States today, and I'm one of those people like let's try to put our disagreements aside at this point, and I say basically there are two ways of looking at two ways of approaching what I call enlightened tribalism, which is basically to say that you know we are to some extent a tribe. We're a tribe of people that, oddly, paradoxically, doesn't count on tribes very much. We're a tribe of people who act like rational actors. We're a tribe of people who are liberal and tolerant to each other. We're a tribe of people who have these values, and we must recognize the distinctiveness of these values and be prepared to defend them. The other position is I call it critical liberalism, which is liberalism that understands the fact that it didn't drop from heaven, that it's not a matter of reading the right books, that liberalism is in fact a serendipitous achievement that can go away, that there's nothing there are no natural rights that protect us. There are no God-given rights that defend themselves. The only rights that we have are ones that we're willing to defend ourselves. And it's, in short, one of the basic themes of the book is that there is no inevitable process by which democracy, liberalism, tolerance will triumph. There is absolutely no reason to believe that. If you accept the idea that just step back and look at the world, if you accept what Huxley calls the cosmic process, which is the rule of the law of the jungle. As Huxley says, the cosmic process is the rule. What he calls the ethical process, where mankind puts away that kind of thing and actually achieves periods of tolerance, those are the exceptions. But we have, in America, gotten that completely reversed. We have come to think that we are the rule. Everyone else is the exception, and we can't quite understand why they are the way they are. But eventually, they're going to become like us. And I feel that there's absolutely no reason whatsoever to think that. And I think it's very dangerous to think that because it lulls us into a sense that we really don't have to do anything. And the problem is we really do. What we have to do, I'm not sure, and I wish I had the answers. But I think, in my defense, I'll put it this way, I think it's better to know what the real problems are, and it's better not to have any false solutions than to go with the false solutions and to go with the false paradigms and hope that they will work, when in fact it's been shown pretty well they're not working.
Thank you. I think you do. I'll say you instead of Harris. That's how I prepared it. If you allow me, I think you do a good job of making explicit the tribal state of mind and social order and disorder of Islamic societies. And I would also agree with you that many in the West are terribly confused by the Islamic world. They're woefully uninformed and are often unwilling to confront radical Islam. You acknowledge that the West is more powerful than the agents of radical Islam. In your book, in terms of military and economic power, that is, so the West has the means to wage and win a war against Islam. But your pessimism lies in the West, the myth of modernity, the denial of fanaticism, the fanaticism of reason, as you call it. You describe in detail the logic inherent in Islamic fanaticism, its tribal nature, its visceral code, and the process by which it's instilled in young men, its resistance to change and the core of where the threat lies, its expansionist tendencies. You declare Huntington useless, as you've just explained, and Fukuyama only partly useful in that he gives us an insight that the end of history is not a global phenomenon, but that it is only something that has come for the West. You prefer to analyze radical Islam's threat to the West by taking a more Darwinian approach to the struggle for existence. This struggle for existence, according to you, is between cultures. It's not clear, but you emphasize a few times cultures. You do not hide your admiration for Hegel. Philosophers have always discussed the place of the individual in the group. Some, like John Locke, assert that, for instance, the state is there for the individual. Others, like Hegel, assert that where the interest of the individual collides with the state prevails. In this, if we replace state with culture, would it be fair to call you Hegelian? I agree with you that Islamic theology is collectivist in nature. It elevates the ummah, the sum total of believers, above the individual. The individual is described as a slave, first of God, then of the caliphate, God's government on earth where Sharia law applies. In a political theory presented within Islam through the state, meaning the caliphate, ruled by God's law, Sharia. I find this creepy, and one of the things that is creepy about Hegel is this can just as much be found in his philosophy as Marxism and other kinds of thoughts that lead to totalitarianism. When I read your book, I can detect a hidden admiration, if that's fair to say, for some aspects of the fierce solidarity, group cohesion, adherence to tradition, and the individual sacrifice needed for these greater goods that are displayed in Islamic society. And these are precisely the things that you miss in the West. You decry individualism run amok, the carpe diem attitude, individual narcissism and selfishness, forgetfulness of tradition and culture, the individual's enlightened self-interest which prevents him from giving his life for anything. Then my question comes, if we give this up, what is the modern liberal West? What distinguishes it from other non-Western nations? Because to me that is essentially Western, and to me all these aspects in their moderate form are strengths and not weaknesses. What I also find remarkable in the book is the clarity with which you describe how a society based on radical collectivism is governed by the law of the jungle, and then at the same time, your blindness for the line of reasoning with which you encourage another form of radical collectivism. I disagree that the way to rescue Western civilization from the path of suicide is to embark on an assault on reason. And for all your understanding of the rise of fanaticism in general and the Islamic manifestation in particular, you string together a jagged chain of thought. You use the term reason, for instance. Your use of the term reason is ambiguous. Enlightenment thinkers preoccupied with both individual freedom and secular unlimited government argued that human reason is fallible. But reason is more than just rational thought. It's also a process of trial and error, the ability to learn from past mistakes. The Enlightenment cannot be fully appreciated without a strong awareness of how frail human reason is. Trial and error. The ability to learn from past mistakes. The Enlightenment cannot be fully appreciated without a strong awareness of how frail human reason is. That is why concepts such as doubt and reflection are central to any form of decision-making based on reason. You put so much emphasis on culture that you forget that societies are not autonomous forces but are made up of individuals. You also seem to confuse the survival tactics of individuals living in tribal societies as the unbending culture of those individuals. On both sides of the divide, you establish there are rational calculators. You acknowledge that many in the Muslim world employ rational tactics in their goal to spread the caliphate, for instance. But I also want to point out that they also employ rational tactics to cope with the challenges they meet in their daily lives. And in terms of the universal daily needs of all individuals, the pendulum swings more in favor of the Enlightenment and reason than it does to radical tribalism and Islam within the Islamic world. The Islamic world today may be the crucible for the revival of enlightenment because that's where most individuals are oppressed. I wasn't born a Westerner, and in me was instilled the visceral cord you talk about to protect the family and clan from outsiders. But I succumbed to Western values. Why? Because in the tribal society, life is unbearable and cruel and terrible, and I'm not alone. Muslims, but their tribal and social constraints have followed them, and they have not resisted it. And our multiculturalism and moral relativism, both movements emphasize the position of the culture, the group, above that of the individual. And both products of romanticism, not reason, have allowed them to self-segregate and perpetuate their anti-liberal ways of life. We have allowed Islamic radicals to spread their hatred in the West and have actively offered very little competition. I think also it's wrong to assume that all Muslims want ruthlessness or have a love for anarchy. It's much safer that way. There is a distinction between Ahmadinejad and his regime and the Iranian people, and there is evidence now that the Iranian people may be on our side. I also think it's much safer to make a distinction between individuals as adherents of Islam, that being born into Islam is not a genetic matter. It's something that you learn and something that you can unlearn. And to criticize it, because on that we completely agree, the theology, Islamic theology as a political theory for social order, is collectivist and evil and ruthless, and the agents of that seek anarchy. Cultures matter, but individuals matter more. You emphasize in the book that cultures matter very much. Cultures produce tribal man. Cultures produce rational actors. Cultures do matter. But individuals matter more. And I would actually say it is individuals who make or break cultures. Individuals reform cultures. They persuade, they cajole, and sometimes, like Churchill, they use force. History is made by men. Culture is made by men. Faith is made by men, preserved perhaps by women. Change is made by individuals. Therefore, culture is dynamic and can change. And in that, I think my attitude is more optimistic than yours. My attitude is more optimistic than yours. Here is where I also criticize today's Western leadership, but for reasons slightly different from yours. We are squandering in the West a great deal and a vital opportunity to compete, for instance, with Saudi Arabia for the minds of those people we have now described as they or as the Muslims. Doing so successfully will require eschewing, for instance, the multiculturalism and the modern and the moral relativism that has plagued the West. I don't think that it is the result of too much reason, but of not enough reason. We should appeal to their faculty of reason, and we should encourage it. And there are those who have it, and we should support those ones who have it. Multiculturalism and moral relativism are romantic notions and have been impervious to criticism based on experience. The benchmark against which all policies based on reason must be judged according to the sound empirical tradition of the Enlightenment. The West may be suicidal, but it's not reason that is the cause of the suicide. It is the anti-reason movements within that are born here in the West. Creating liberal Westerners out of the West's Muslim immigrants, I would rather say persuading them, will require rejecting multiculturalism and moral relativism. It also seems in general that you stack the deck unfairly against reason. You characterize those who brought about the French Revolution as having acted according to reason, but the American and British in World War II as having employed non-reason, but rather tribal tactics. But you know as well as I do that in addition to the philosophy tradition of the Enlightenment that grew out of France, another more valid tradition of reason developed in the West, empiricism, in which rational thought exists alongside experience and in which rational thought is tested against the real world. You describe Chamberlain as having been blinded by reason and Churchill as having acted according to the law of the jungle. But wouldn't it be more accurate to characterize Chamberlain as having been blinded by a hope entirely unsubstantiated by historical evidence, and Churchill as having successfully employed experience-tested reason? I will conclude. The subtitle of your book on the printed title page is slightly different from that of the book jacket. It reads, Radical Islam's Threat to the Enlightenment. I would like to propose that rather than radical Islam being a threat to the Enlightenment is a threat to radical Islam. In terms of the solutions you offer in your book, you attempt to create a consensus between conservatives and liberals regarding the threat that Islam, radical Islam, poses to the West, and that is to be praised. but you seem to display the same utopist idealism you criticize in others by entertaining the solutions you suggest, such as enlightened tribalism and critical liberalism. Enlightened tribalism is an oxymoron. When individuals within a tribe, even an artificial one, get enlightened, they are no longer tribal. Tribalism, because of its elevation of group interest above the rights and freedoms of the individual, evolves into totalitarianism. It is one thing to understand how the tribal code works. It's quite another to advocate for conservatives bound by shared ideas and shared interests with an exit option, an option that a tribe simply does not allow. Critical liberalism is, as far as I can observe, in the United States, very healthy. There's a lot of debate and active civil society and even what I would call a missionary group that goes into Africa and other third world countries to alleviate poverty. There is every reason to believe that democracy and frees Japan and Germany into liberal democracies. And that was only possible after they had attacked the West and after they had been defeated entirely. So to preserve and defend Western civilization, I think must act similarly with countries once they attack us, not provoke attack. If we are attacked, and you contend in various places in the book that we cannot employ Churchillian tactics without losing our civilization, the opposite may be true. America and England, both highly sophisticated and civilized countries, successfully defeated fascism and Nazism, and other dangerous and civilized countries successfully defeated fascism and Nazism and other dangerous anti-liberal ideology during the Second World War. When faced with an enemy that employs the law of the jungle and creates a context for a struggle of survival, the Americans and the British responded accordingly. And we will be committing suicide if we do not employ our reason and learn the crucial lessons of that conflict. Thank you.
Ayam, thank you very much. Lee, I'd like to turn the podium back to you for a response to Ayam.
Well, thank you very much.
It was supposed to be provocative.
I think it's wonderful that I think it's absolutely wonderful that you're so optimistic, and it makes me feel better. I told someone that when I wrote this book, I felt a bit like an astronomer who's come up with this calculation: the meteor is heading straight towards the Earth, and it's going to kill us all. And it's like he's proud of his working out this theory, but he'd kind of like to find someone who finds a hole in it, you know, and says your math was wrong. I have no problem with anybody saying, "Oh, about your conclusion," because it's not a pleasant conclusion. Let me just again with one point. You say that my use of the word reason is ambiguous in the book. It certainly is. But underlying that is the fact that the whole concept of reason is extremely ambiguous. It would require, and I hope maybe one day to write a book about the whole variety of what the word reason means. And it was something that plagued me in the book because I like more analytical clarity than I was able to give it. But the ambiguity of reason is, in fact, to go back to Hegel, who I can tell you're not quite as fond of as I am. Hegel, in fact, saw the ambiguity of reason. And when I think it's important to understand where Hegel's coming from, is that Hegel was reacting to the excesses of the Enlightenment. There were people in the Enlightenment, like Condorcet, who really did think that reason was sufficient by itself as a force that would just liberate mankind. In my book, I have a quote from the sketch of human progress that he wrote when he was when the French revolutionaries were looking for him to cut his head off. And he basically says all we need to do to enlighten all the other nations that live in darkness is since we worked out the proofs for them, we can just show them what we've done. You know, hand them the Descartes, and that will be enough to make other countries enlightened. So that's I think you will agree a very naive view of the of reason in that sense. What Hegel was looking at is that he realized that you can push reason too far. You can push reason to the point where it does commit suicide. That is a naive faith in reason that does not fully recognize the challenge of irrationality will in fact end up by having reason commit suicide. Hegel, in terms of the collectivism and the state thing, I know Hegel's not a popular thinker among most American conservatives. I think in one of Hegel's early writings, he actually says that it's very dangerous for a state to interfere too much in the individual's lives, because he said the state has a mission to only interfere when it comes down to a real crunch, that is, when the society is in danger. If it starts interfering with how you know your private life, then you stop respecting the state. The state has to can only play its card, its trump card, when it really counts. That is, for example, during time of war. In both World War I and World War II, as you know, and you were talking about the American and the British efforts in World War II, the British had a horror of the draft. They were pushed into a draft in World War I because it was against their basic libertarian ethos. But unless there was a draft, unless you chose names of people and said, you're going to fight for your country, we would not have won World War II. We wouldn't have been able to fight it, hardly. In other words, what Hegel is saying is that there are times Hobbes had said, listen, you have no obligation to fight for your society. Your obligation stops with your self-interest. The only reason you enter into a covenant to form a society is out of your self-interest. So therefore, and Hobbes is very explicit about this, he says, okay, if you're ordered to fight, to risk your life, you have no duty to do that. You can run off. You can just hide in the woods. The king has every right to kill you, of course, and it may not be prudent to hide in the woods, but you have no moral obligation. Hegel's point is that, well, you do have a moral obligation. That is, when it comes to a matter of the survival of your community, there are certain things that you're called upon to do which cancel out your pursuit of self-interest. And I think most Americans, most everyone here, I think, would accept that. And it doesn't necessarily – Hegel's not defending totalitarianism, which is something way in the future. And I know that he gets criticized because Marx took him over, and then Marx gets criticized because Lenin took him over. But, Marx one time was asked, what will it look like when the state withers away? And he says, it will be kind of like the middle – okay, now that's not what happened, but this is not Marx's idea. When he said the state will wither away, that's what he meant. The state obviously didn't under the Soviet communists, but then they violated every principle of Marxism. Okay, but going back to the Hegel is that there I think he has a point when he says that the communities do have a right at certain critical moments to say you cannot follow your self-interest here. Paying taxes, for example, is one of them, and other things like that. So you don't have to buy into the full idea of the collective thing just cancels out the individual. You have to find a balance there. Now, the visceral code thing is an interesting – I'm glad you brought it up, because I think this is a critical idea, and I wish I could get it because I think this is a critical idea, and I wish I could get it kind of accepted as a concept of interest. Because the visceral code, the definition of the visceral code, it's something we don't realize we have. I first learned about it when I was in a train to Vienna, and a guy sitting across from me, who was Viennese, started asking me, "What is it about you Americans standing in line, getting in queues?" And it's like, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Why do you line up to stand in line to get tickets or something?" And I said, "Well, that's obvious. That's what you have to do." And of course, my first day in Vienna taught me that, well, this is not how all cultures work. Suddenly I was aware that there was this thing inside of me that I thought was just obvious, natural, programmed genetically, that, you stand in line, the first person there gets first serve, and the second person second serve. I thought this was just programmed into me at a genetic level. It wasn't. It was learned at some point. But it was learned at such an early point, I didn't realize I was learning it, and the people who taught me didn't realize they were teaching it. The visceral code is something that is transmitted precognitively. It's something where you feel it. It's like the analogy I use in my book is that when you blush out of shame, you don't say, "Now's the time for me to blush." You blush. You feel the shame before you even reach it. Sometimes you even deny that you're feeling the shame. So we're talking about something that happens on the physical level, the physiological level. It manifests itself in sweating palms and all that kind of thing. It's like when you did something dangerous, when you stopped thinking along the lines you were supposed to, you felt that tension. You felt that visceral code. And it's not genetic. And that's my point. But it's very difficult to change. It can be changed. But it's very difficult to change. It changes very slowly. And I think so much of what we call culture is, in fact, the visceral code, that it's something that we're not even aware of feeling. And this is one of the things why it makes it very difficult for two cultures to communicate, because the fact is they're not aware of this element of their personality, that they simply don't see it. It's like me and the guy in the train to Vienna. It's, I didn't know what he was talking about. And I think this happens a great deal, especially in communications between Islam and us, is that we don't know what they're talking about, what they're meaning, and they don't know what we're talking about, because they don't recognize that what they're dealing with is something that's been programmed into them by people who didn't realize that they were even programming them. An example I use is Captain Cook in his voyages goes to a group of people in the Sandwich Islands or someplace, and he says, you know, why do the guys eat separately from the females here? You know, why do you have the females eat over here and the guys eat here? In England, we don't do that. And the chief doesn't know what to say. He says, well, it's because it's right and necessary. And whenever somebody says, you know, why do you feel this way, and you stutter and say, because it's right and necessary, that's a sign of the visceral code. And I think this is in my essay, The Future Tradition, I actually argue that the visceral code is the DNA of a community, that the DNA of a community can change. I mean, the DNA of an individual can change. It can be, you know, over the course of generations. But the DNA of the community is the visceral code, and it too is very difficult to change, but it can be changed. But the question is always how. It's such a challenge to change, as I think you're probably the best living witness I can imagine. But getting back to, you say I have a grudging, a hidden admiration for the collectivity, the group, and I think you're right. I want to say that you are absolutely right. One of the reasons for that, however, is because all my life I had been a loner and an independent. As Chris says, I am not affiliated with any think tank, any university. I wrote this book all, you know, without, you know, vetting it through anybody. You know, I am, and I have a wonderful line in my book called "Loners Are Losers." Okay, and I know that. You know, there's a price to be paid to be independent, to be alone. I've written a much shorter book called "Infidel" myself, because I was raised a Southern Baptist, and I was raised, you know, to believe that everything in the Bible was literally true. And at the age of 14, I got into, well, an encounter with the people in my Sunday school. And everyone tried to get me to change my mind, to toe the line. And, you know, my mother even came to me and said, you know, Lee, would it really hurt just to say, yeah, I believe? You know, you don't have to mean it. Just say I just like Galileo did, you know. And it's like, well, no, I'm not going to do that. And I went to the final episode of this saga. It was a Sunday school meeting where all the classes got together, and the preacher was up, and I was dealing with the preacher. And I had no allies and stuck with me to the final week, you know, the trial. But the difference is this, is they were glad to get rid of me. Okay? They didn't go out and they didn't say, we've got to gun this guy down, we have to, you know, we need to tear him apart. Apostasy, my apostasy was greeted with great glee by my Southern Baptist colleagues. Okay? So in other words, even a group that we think of as being hidebound, fundamentalist, I mean, they still are part of the popular culture of reason in the United States. They don't, you know, they have their ideas. They will defend their ideas. They will try to persuade you they're right. But that's it. Beyond that, they do not go. And that's why my book would have been much shorter than yours. So.
I just wanted to respond by saying I'm not convinced by Hegel, and that I really think Hegel is not a critic of the Enlightenment, an inside critic, but that he's really an anti-Enlightenment in the sense that he elevates the collective above the individual, whereas the Enlightenment movement started by putting the individual at the center of everything. There were other thinkers who pointed to the excesses of Enlightenment and said, let's not get carried away with the whole thing of reason. And that was, for instance, David Hume, Edmund Burke, and many others who have emphasized why such concepts as doubt and reflection and so on are important in that. So I really think that Hegel is a variation and so on are important in that. So I really think that Hegel is a very dangerous.
Well, we'll need to talk about Hegel at a later time, or have a long email correspondence.
I'm going to open things up to question, comments, general discussion, and I'm going to start with one question, a piece of my own for Lee and for Ayan. I want to ask Lee if it is not, in fact, the case, an historical fact, that within Islam there is a history, a tradition of reason and of rational action, of discourse, of science, of math, even of philosophical speculation in the long history of this religion. Within the context of Islamic society, do we not have some examples that might be appealed to in an effort to revive a former and the most glorious period of that religion's history? To Ayan, so I'm trying to counter a little bit your pessimism. So, you know, is it really a lost cause? To Ayan, I want to ask her how far she really goes in placing individualism, the individual, at the center of politics. Are you not willing to acknowledge that to some extent successful individualism exists within a context, within a historical group, within a nation state, within a culture? Was not the Enlightenment not only a reaction but an intellectual movement that took place within a specific culture and tradition? Is not the American tradition one that came about through certain historical developments such as has Lee adumbrated in his talk and discusses in his book? Do you not have some concern that by emphasizing the appeal to the individual as a matter of reason, that you could be criticized for being too abstract, too romantic? It might be not as dangerous a form of abstractionism as that of the French Directorate or of Lee Bollinger's saying we have to be tolerant about everything. But aren't you willing to concede that individualism has to be in some kind of a context? So I'll start with those two questions, and then we're going to open things up.
Lee? Me first? Well, obviously there is. I mean, one of the thinkers I quote most often in both books is Ibn Khaldun. And here's an example of one of the finest minds I think that ever thought about history. And I think that it's quite obvious that there was a tradition within Islam in which reason and in all the good, in our good senses, was very alive and well. But there's disturbing things, though. It's like you have a situation. One of the great Muslim thinkers, Averroes, who influenced Western thought a great deal. But there's a very curious thing. His influence on Western thought was this, is that Averroes said that human beings, he was going back to Aristotle, who said that the human being was a combination of a soul and a body. Okay, and what Averroes says, well, what happens after death? Okay, what happens after death is the body goes away and the soul is there. And at that point, our individual souls merge together into this collective soul, okay? And the Christian Averroes, who took this over, of course, was as some of people here know, was a heresy. It was that idea was it annihilated the individual, you know. And so here you have a thinker, but he's thinking in order to come up with an idea that annihilates the individual. Al-Ghazali, who was a major thinker, his role in Islamic thought is a bit like Nagarjuna's role in Buddhist thought, where you have this breathtaking dialectical feat that shows that reason is pointless, which is a bit like Hume's position in the West, where ultimately Hume is saying, okay, you reason, and you get a headache, and you can't make sense of anything, and everything becomes a puzzle and a contradiction, and then you have to go out and play pool and have a few drinks, you know, to get back to normal life. So there is this self-destructive thing of reason, which I think has to be looked at, and it goes back to Abelard, you know, with his pro-con, the ideas, this point and this point, how to resolve them. And I won't mention the fact that Hegel tries to deal with this very issue in his thinking, which is that, yes, that's the nature of reason. The nature of reason is that kind of self-destructive criticism you're never satisfied with the position that you have, which I think goes back to Socrates. I think instead of looking forward to totalitarianism, you need to look back to Socrates. Socrates is always asking, you know, always questioning. I think people have this idea of Socrates as this smart aleck who knew the answer and kept, you know, saying, well, you don't know the answer, and I'm going to make fun of you. But it's because he didn't know the answer either. And that's why he is such a difficult, he's asking you those questions, because he's asked himself those very questions before. And that's why so many of the Socratic, the ones that most obviously reflect Socrates, and then aporia, which is a Greek word meaning uncertainty, meaning doubt. But it means a state of doubt that has been introduced by a dialectic. That is, it's not the doubt you begin with. It's a doubt that you're suddenly brought to realize that, oh, I don't really know what I'm talking about, which I think is a very healthy moment for most of us.
Ayan.
Yes, I concede. I definitely concede that the individual cannot be, you can't think of the individual human being only as an abstract and operating all alone. As humans, we are social animals, and a social order like this one, for instance, preserves and tries to protect that culture of reason and the one we are describing and defending. But let me point to, for instance, what Thomas Hobbes responds to in his time, where the great separation, where he says, let's not have spokesmen for God anymore, but let's leave unto God what is God's, and let's as men create our own way. And from then, the culture is established that makes it possible for individuals to agree, to disagree, and to go about their affairs. At least the thoughts have been established. And we create then a context and a culture that makes it possible for individuals to disagree without violence, or without at least with a minimum of violence. And between Thomas Hobbes' time and until now, many years and many hundreds of years have passed. But my point is, it is because of individuals like Hobbes who have, by thinking this through and putting down their ideas first, and between the time that he put his ideas down until what we have now, it was inconceivable, and that's where my optimism stems from. It is not to say that the culture was first and then the individuals came last, but because individuals are more than just the sum total of all of us sitting here, we are able to innovate and we are able to respond. I think that reason has a lot of limits. Because we are individual human beings, we have limits. But because in the Enlightenment we acknowledged that, and we made it possible through that process of trial and error that we stumble along, and we are now faced with a very dangerous enemy. I do not underestimate that enemy. But to say that there is a state of emergency today in which we are going to give the state more power, or at least the interest of the collective above the individual, is to give up what we are. What would then be the difference between the United States and Saudi Arabia if we do that? And when do we declare a state of emergency? And who declares that state of emergency? I think in this Churchill gave the answer himself. He said, democracy is a bad form of government, but it is the best form of government.
I'm going to turn to the to the audience, to everybody here, and ask people to ask questions or make comments. Yes, sir. And, oh, excuse me, we have a roving microphone. If you could please identify yourself briefly before you ask your question.
Yes, my name is Frank Fletcher. My question for the panelists would be, do they believe that a transformation or change that's very significant would occur within Islam, in the Islamic world? Is it necessary to have confrontation with them? I mean, the West? I mean, because you mentioned Churchill, one of our panelists did. Or would it be something in the way of some type of movement or movements that would be led from within the Islamic world? Or would you see it more as being something that would come from people in the Western world who are Islamic based on the principle that what is transferred is transformed. I was thinking of Sun Yat-sen going back to China with his American experience, but maybe that's not a very good analogy because that that approach failed in China ultimately, although in Costa Rica you had a general imposed democracy. So,
one of the problems I have is with the very concept of democracy, and I want to distinguish between two things. One is democracy that exists at the visceral code level, and that is where we agree that everyone is kind of our equal. Everyone should, you know, this, the fair play idea, the idea that you know, everyone, if you work for, hard for something, you get to keep what you have. These are all these are things that exist not at the ideological level, but at the visceral level. That is something that we have been, that's part of the what religion has given us, what our culture has given us. The idea that somehow we can go in and take the superficial paraphernalia of democracy and say, here, no matter what your visceral code is, there it is. If we are taught, if I'm taught, but to go to my mullah or go to my my professor at Columbia and say, what should I think? Then, you know, if you have a whole bunch of people following around a guru, and that guru has a stupendous power. It's like in Iraq where we said, okay, we have al-Sistani on our side. Whatever he says, you know, 60% of the population will go along with. Well, this isn't anyone's idea of democracy. So it certainly wasn't Cardon So's idea of democracy, which was that everyone had to think for himself. This is why Jefferson wanted to have only yeoman, you know, farmers participate in democracy, because all these people will be thinking for themselves. They will not be beholden to anybody else. They will not look at, you know, they won't go to their priest or go to anybody. They'll, you know, they won't even go to their Protestant pastor. They will think for themselves. So if you have a society in which, you know, in which everyone is a pastor, they will think for themselves. So if you have a society in which, you know, in which everyone is just automatically going along with a particular figure, you know, you can't, it won't work. You can pretend, you can make believe you're installing democracy. You can call it all the right words. And I think one of the problems with intellectuals in general is that they forget the enormous gap between words and things. And you could, it's fine. It's like when we turned over quote unquote sovereignty to Iraq. It's like, We made this proclamation, you are now sovereign. But that's like looking at a 2-year-old boy and say, you are now an adult. It doesn't work.
Will a transformation occur in the Islamic world? I think that transformation is occurring, and it's not always going in the direction that we want it to go. I like to keep on pointing to Saudi Arabia as a kind of Vatican City of Islam, because it's about the only organized state where radical Islam or Islam is spread from, besides Iran. What you see is the authoritarian state or authoritarian states, and that populations rebel against that. For instance, I read Bin Laden and the Bin Laden movement as a rebellion against that kind of state and, you know, authoritarian Islam. What he is proposing is not what we want, but it has caught the imagination of the Muslim world. At least it has established the concept among most Muslims that they can think for themselves. They can read the Quran themselves. The Islamic Brotherhood is also about that. We don't like what they are saying. We don't want the way they read the Quran. We don't want them to take it literally. But it has established the idea that you no longer need a state or an imam or some clergy person to read the Quran for you. That might result, that's where my optimism, and it is gradual, that the rate of literacy in the Muslim world will improve, because individuals who no longer want to follow exploiters will start reading the Quran themselves. Now, for some, it's going to lead to the path of jihadism, like Muhammad Buhari, who killed the Prophet Muhammad, because he reasoned, if I believe, who killed Theo van Gogh, who insulted the Prophet Muhammad. He reasoned, if I have to follow the Prophet Muhammad literally, then I have to know what he is telling me. And he read him. There are others, and I include myself among those, that when I started to read the Quran myself, it didn't lead me into becoming a jihadist. It led to quite the opposite direction, And what you see within the Islamic world, and especially among Muslims in the West, is this tendency that the more individuals take an active interest in their own theology, that the response is very interesting. It's true that some, probably the most, are still apathetic, but it is a trend that can grow. Now, do we confront theology and do we confront radical Islam? My answer is yes. That confrontation does not necessarily have to be military. When they use words, we use words. Da'wah, or spreading by missionary means across the world, Wahhabism is something that we can easily compete with and confront with words. For everywhere they place a madrasa, we can place a school next to it, spreading what we believe in. I believe in secular liberalism. I am an atheist. If I had the money and the means, I would be putting that. But then we are faced with the problem, for instance, in countries like Pakistan and other Muslim countries, that, for instance, if you want to spread Islam in the West, you can, because of the code, the freedom codes that we have, but you cannot spread Christianity or secular liberalism or Judaism or something else in Islamic worlds, because the authoritarian nations, the authoritarian states there, will prevent you from doing that, or the believers might use violence and the authorities will not dissuade them from doing that. Now, that is on the political level, and that, I think, is a confrontation the state can carry off. But I'm definitely for confrontation. And confrontation of Islamic theology within the West should be easy, in the same way that Christian theology was confronted. And by saying that, I'm not saying that Christian theology and Islamic theology are the same. I'm just saying that Christianity has been scrutinized and questioned and so on. We can't exercise that kind of critical scrutiny towards Islam as well.
This gentleman here, who had a question, and then Michael, you're next, and then we have a couple of questions.
Thank you. I'm Amr Ramadan. I'm from Egypt. I'm Amr Ramadan. I'm from Egypt, and I wish to thank the speakers. Can you hear me? Yeah. And just two points, and probably just a quick question on the analogy of Islam and the West being in confrontation. I beg to differ with the two speakers, because here we are mixing apple and oranges. Islam is a religion, while the West is a civilization or a group of countries or nations. So if you put them at odds, I don't think we will reach... working on that assumption would lead us probably to a miss or different paths. On the issue of slavery, which I think Ayan raised, I guess that Islam, and I'm Muslim myself, Islam has to do more of liberating Muslims from slavery, being it slavery to money, to livelihood, to certain lifestyle, but it certainly doesn't ask people to go to slavery. The question I have, which is apparent from the discussions we had today, is that certainly Mr. Lee also has read this, that there is a great confrontation probably going between people living in the East, being them Muslims, and people living in the West. That gap is widening, and it's quite alarming that the gap is widening, especially here in the United States. I can feel that. Is there anything that you have in mind in order to close that gap, or at least work toward closing that gap in the future? Because I guess it's harmful for both societies and both nations, both parts of the world, to have that gap widening over time. Thank you.
I wish I had a magic bullet here to solve this. But I think, oddly, paradoxically enough, it might help if we understand. In the West, we oftentimes want to stress what we have in common with people. But it might really help here if we understand our differences, if we understand how different we are. I had a professor taught me religion who studied with an Islamic expert at the University of Chicago, and he said basically the greatest problem Christians have understanding Islam is they assume it's something kind of like Christianity. They don't realize how different it really is. And I think that if we start with that assumption, understanding how different the cultures are, and it's just like the incident I said about the train ride in Vienna. It's like by talking to this guy and realizing the differences between us, I understood myself better, and I understood his culture better. And it ended up with being kind of a win-win. It at least will keep us from making horrible misunderstandings and horrible, acts of just miscomprehension, which I think is one of the real dangers today on both sides.
Yes, Islam is a religion, and as a religion and a political philosophy in Islam, faith and political affairs are not separated. It is contrary to liberal philosophy in the West. It is contrary to the philosophy of the Enlightenment on which Western civilization is built. It starts with the separation of church and state, the treatment of women, the way we regard and appreciate life here on Earth, everything that Islam preaches about life and freedom is opposed to what is understood in the West about life and freedom. I think that can change, and I think that individual Muslims can reform Islam. But I think it is wrong to insist that radical Islam is compatible with liberal democracy as a theology, as a theory. On the issue of slavery, you said Islam liberates people from being slaves to money, from having a lifestyle. I think that is not what I would call liberation. You become, as a Muslim, you are to submit to the will of God, and God demands that you obey his rules, which are to sort of sacrifice your life here on earth for the hereafter. And that's precisely why it is contrary to the Enlightenment.
Michael Novak here at AEI. Good to see you again, Lee, and Ayan, of course. I would like to support Ayan's optimism on the one hand and disagree a bit about or raise some questions about the meaning of enlightenment used by both authors. On Ayan's behalf, one reason I am optimistic is that the tremendous suffering of the Muslim world, particularly the Arab Muslim world, in the last 75 years or so, the lack of dignity and the lack of liberty for individuals is increasingly felt as television and other things bring other images into people's lives, and they come to see what they don't have and can't do. Also, we have been very lucky in our enemies, in the Taliban in Afghanistan, the regime in Iran, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In a village in Taliban, this is not untypical, a dissident was skinned alive as a warning to the village. In Iraq, a young boy of 11 was baked and presented to his family for dinner. A family in a village they were trying to intimidate. And you can multiply these stories by hundreds. That's one reason we are seeing the Sunni rebellion. Also, the seizing of Sunni women by Al-Qaeda operatives. And there are lots of Muslims who increasingly don't want to go back to the 7th century barbarism. You know, I don't want to argue about how widespread such things were in the 7th century, but they were close enough. But part of the world has outgrown those and come to see them as uncivilized and barbarous. And I think that sense is growing up in Islam. As I read the polling data, the popularity of Al-Qaeda and its kind of activities are declining. The popularity of the regime in Iran is declining precipitously, and so on. So I think there are some forces in real life in the world. I call this the via negativa. When you learn to go in a certain direction because you're turning away from something too awful to endure, too awful to live with, that drives you in another direction. You don't know what the destination is. Now, on the question of enlightenment, I want first to point to its ambiguities. Ayan pointed to one, the difference between the French and, for that matter, the German-Russian enlightenment and the Anglo-American. There's the difference between the enlightenment as a form of reason, meaning logic and calculation, the 2 plus 2 equal 4 kind of mind that Albert Camus wrote so much against. And there's the reason of common sense, or of experience, or of the empirical. On another axis altogether, in one meaning of enlightenment, it means to turn to reason and take more from it and learn its lessons better than we have before. But there's another sense in which it is a project to live without God. It's a project to... It's against God, put it that way. The reason is sufficient unto itself. Now, I think, given the history of the 20th century, we have reason to doubt that. Reason, enlightenment, left us goes in such crazy directions and went in such crazy directions, contrary to one another everywhere, all over you, the ideologies. I think, in fact, the West has a... forgive me, two wings to fly on. Its religion, Judaism and Christianity, and a good part of which Islam shares, as witnessed Al-Ghazali and Averroes and the others you cited, choice given Adam and Eve, and then Abel and Cain, and every chapter in the Bible is about individual liberty. It's the key that unlocks the whole Bible. And God is understood as logos, as mind, as governor, so that there are things God, even God, cannot do. Well, I just want to say that I think that if we attempted to impose a kind of secularism or atheism upon the whole world, it would be a fruitless project. And I rather think we have to find some way of imagining both religion and reason in ways that bring about the peace between them in the soul, so to speak. And the one checks the other in real life.
Can I? Yeah, I think you have an absolutely wonderful point, very important point. And I think it goes back, let me put it in my own way, is that I think there's a very, very grave misconception of the causes of the Enlightenment. Let me just mention one thing, is that John Knox, who most people would regard as a pretty, as a first-class fanatic nowadays, he decided in Scotland, when he basically got control of the Carrick, he decided that there would be universal education for all males. Okay, every male would have to be able to read. It was the first time in mankind's history that anyone had said, okay, all the male boys in our society are going to be taught how to read. Why? So they could read the Bible. So they could read the Bible for themselves. Okay, flip forward a century or two later, and we have David Hume. David Hume was an infidel. He was an atheist, pretty much. At his funeral, somebody said, you kin, he was an atheist. And someone else responded, yes, but an honest atheist. Well, he was an honest atheist. And he was honest enough to recognize the role that Christianity, even Christian fanaticism, had played in the liberation of the human mind. He has a little charming little thing about where he says, talks about the difference between superstition and fanaticism. He says, a fanatic thinks he has, the vision of God, but that the next generation, that kind of calms down and people are just thinking for themselves. Because the fanatic, the Protestant fanatics thought for themselves. They looked at the Bible and they said, oh, we can make up our own mind about this. We don't need anyone to tell us what to do. This transforms itself eventually into this mode of operating where people say, well, I'm going to think for myself. And eventually they end up thinking for themselves in the way that someone like David Hume does. So I think that the idea that the Enlightenment kind of fell from heaven, or fell from someplace, no, I shouldn't mention heaven, but fell someplace, down on earth, is quite wrong. I think that the foundations of the Enlightenment go back into the Protestant and the Catholic tradition. And the whole, as you say, the whole idea in Catholicism of the notion that St. Thomas has, that, God must behave reasonably, is that God cannot, he simply is not against reason, but he is, in some sense, the embodiment of reason. And I think that this tradition is so absolutely critical.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it is one thing to say there is no evidence for the existence of God and to accept that position. It's quite another thing to go about imposing that conviction on other people. I think for those of us, for that part of the Enlightenment that I'm most attracted to, and that is the Anglo-American, and there are some very fine French and German Enlightenment thinkers, but the part that I find attractive is not the one that says we should go about imposing it on people. I think that it is, in fact, impossible to impose. You can persuade and you can have a conversation, and that's a major part of the Enlightenment, is to argue and to reason. And also from the other side. From the other side, I think that once you've come to the conclusion that there is no evidence for the existence of God, that on the side of believers, it would be polite if they were not to go about imposing their faith on others. And if we look at the history of enlightenment and the history of faith, what we find is that those who adhere to faith are those with a tradition of imposing their views on others.
Well, it would take a long discussion of history, but I don't think the history of Christianity is a history of imposition. I think the conversions from the beginning were often among the poorest and among intellectuals, and they were by persuasion. There was, you know, for three centuries, there was no official state or anything to protect them, and on through history. But and you know, the Reformation and so on. Well, I can't go on.
Well, just one little chapter from what you're talking about is the French Jesuits, I mean, who went to Canada, and their experience with the Indians. I mean, and these people, they did not try to impose their ideas on anybody. They really just, they lived with them. They basically would say things, or Matteo Ricci, when he went to China, he wasn't trying to impose his ideas on anybody. He basically, he learned Chinese, he dressed like a Mandarin, he read all the literature, and when the topic came up, when something came up about, you know, what, I think you're right. I think that that is essential to understand that so much of Christianity has spread this way and not been imposed.
This gentleman here, and then you're next, and then Bonnie, and then you can go around like that. Yes.
Well, I'll do it quickly. I want to say that
you can introduce yourself to everybody.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gary Mitchell from the Mitchell Report. You've been sort of flying at 50,000 feet, which I love the nature of this conversation. I want to bring it down to ground level. And in this question, and if it's not appropriate, you can just move on to the next one. I love the notion about the ambiguity of reason, which strikes me as a tautology, because it seems to me reason itself admits of ambiguity. But there's been a lot of talk about it, and I'm trying to sort of get a sense of where your worldview is and how it conforms to things that happen day in and day out. So, given the ambiguity of reason point of view, what is your quick critique of Colombia's invitation to Ahmadinejad and Bollinger's introduction of Ahmadinejad?
I think it was a very strange. My feelings were very strange about it, because I feel like it was kind of a pseudo dialogue. It's not a good thing. If you wanted to talk to the, if you wanted to let the guy express himself, then just let him express himself instead of attacking him. If he thought that this guy was worthy of being attacked, he shouldn't have invited him. I mean, that's how I feel. Is that, you know, I know that's probably bizarre, but it's like, this is kind of my southern point of view, is that, you know, when you invite somebody to your place, you don't attack him. I mean, I don't care who he is. But if you don't like him and want to attack him, don't invite him to your place. You always have that point of view, is that, you know, when you invite somebody to your place, you don't attack him. I mean, I don't care who he is. But if you don't like him and want to attack him, don't invite him to your place. You always have that option.
I think that if universities want to arrange freak shows, they can, and this was a freak show. I think also that it is very strange that just from a certain radius from the university that he would probably be arrested for having taken hostages or having been involved in the hostage taking in the Iranian embassy. Was it in 1979? So in a way, I think this is perverting the freedom of free expression of opinions and free speech, which he has, and I'm proud to say that we live in a country where he can come and be the freak.
Jasil Moore from Al Jazeera. Far from philosophy, quick question. The main criticism to the regimes in the Muslim world is that coming from the West is that they're mostly oppressive and authoritarian. And on the other hand, the criticism from that part of the world to the West, and namely to the U.S., is that its policies make it look, make it seem as if it's an arrogant and, in some extent, imperialistic nation. Putting the religion aside for a moment, to what extent do you feel that U.S. policy, particularly in the Middle East, fuels this radical Islam and gives it a reason to recruit or to get wider in reach? Keeping in mind, while you answer the question, keep in mind that some of the most oppressive regimes in the Middle East are considered to be the closest allies to America.
Well, you know, yeah, this is a political question, and I wish I had a clearer answer. I think that so much of what we have done has been a mistake, and it's been a mistake because we just didn't understand each other. Once again, I'm not trying to sell the idea that we need to sympathize with each other. I'm trying to sell the idea we need to understand what the other party is and what the other party is wrestling with and what you value. And I think that, for example, I think the decision, the Iraqi war was extremely misguided in terms of the attempt to bring about a liberal democracy in a society that had been, leave alone the whole question of Islam, but a society that had been treated, had gone through a period of what's learned helplessness. I mean, Saddam basically taught his people to be helpless. I mean, they were on the dole. They had no rights to speak out, but they didn't have they didn't even have to take care of themselves. So it was a kind of what in sociology is called learned helplessness, where you teach someone that they can't do anything to help themselves. And the idea is that you can somehow take people like that and presto, make them, you know, into a liberal democratic society is really, and once again, it has nothing to do with Islam. But so many of the as you said, the oppressive regimes to which we're friendly do that as well. And that's the problem here, is that, you know, on the one hand, every nation has the right to consult its interest amorally to better itself in the world struggle. But at the same time, if our long-term interest, if it's the idea of somehow calming everything down, I think our long-term interest lies in once again trying to understand the other party and not assuming that you guys are like us, or that using ourselves as a model to predict what your behavior will be like, and to understand that once again, you can, even leaving Islam aside, you can look at oppressive regimes do things to people, and it makes it very hard to overcome.
By saying let's put religion aside, it's like inviting you to a barbecue and then saying let's put the meat aside. The attack on the 9th of 11 was about religion. The people who attacked us, they did it because they believe in what they say. Ahmadinejad's leading a theocracy, and what's motivating him is religion. Saudi Arabia is spreading anti-Semitism, and that is founded on religion. We cannot, if we want to address this, put religion aside, put Islam aside. I'm sorry, because Islam still has politics and faith so intertwined that unless the two are separated, we cannot, unfortunately, put religion aside.
I agree with you there. Once again, as I said earlier, I think this is one of the things where we just misunderstand each other. For us in the United States, religion is a matter of our private conscience. It's just, it's like, what religion do you belong to? It's like, what church do you belong to? But it's like, religion in Islam from the very beginning has not simply been a religion in that sense. It has been a polity. It has been a religion. It was an entire social order. And this I think, is one of the fundamental points of incomprehension between us and Islam, is that your Islam is more than we want to buy in terms of religion. We want something we can just do it, you know, every now and then, and doesn't make a lot, and that won't make many demands on us. And as religion develops in the United States, it's making fewer and fewer demands on the congregations. So we're talking about two very, very different things here.
Bonnie Wachtel, let me address this to Ayan Hirsi Ali, and first let me say I really enjoyed your comments. I'd like to address your attention to a poll that was taken in France at the time that the United States invaded Iraq. And in that poll, a majority of young men in France said that they would not fight to defend the country unless the homeland were directly threatened. And I believe a third of the men questioned said that they would not fight to defend France even if the homeland were directly threatened. Now, I don't want to be unfair to that country, but the fact is, if that is true, it's a perfect example of a situation in which the emotional bonds, which Mr. Harris refers to as enlightened tribalism, have weakened to the extent, even in a very rational, enlightened country, to which the society is would be unable to fill the function that we understand a society to fill. Now, in the United States, in contrast, when you were growing up in Somalia, I was growing up in the United States, and in that experience, there was quite a bit of indoctrination going on here as well, in a very good sense, that we were all taught in the public schools to take this whole constellation of values that we have in the enlightened, individualism, freedom, progress, the family, all of it together, and you wrap it in an emotional folder called patriotism. So you take the value of reason and you're supposed to love it. It is set in an emotional, visceral framework that allows people to sacrifice and to fight for it. I kind of take the discussion that you had on the panel today as a question of where should the balance be struck in the United States today to be going more towards pressing those less strictly rational levers, which then allow you to understand how the enemy is thinking also, or to go more in the direction of pure reason, individualism, which I would think a little more towards what we have in France today. I was a little disturbed that you want to be on that side of the balance. Is it a correct interpretation of your comments?
No, I apologize for the confusion. I'm not saying let's go in the direction of France. I'm just saying that it is not because of a lack of reason or because of It's not because of too much reason that, for instance, France is in the position that it is in now with this alarming poll. I think it's because of a lack of reason or because of a limitation of reason. When you take a poll, opinion that you get back must be free and informed. France is a free nation. But the way the French population has been informed for years, their education system at the visceral level is that it is possible. To live in this world without war, without confrontation. You can talk, and that you describe very well in your book, that you can resolve all problems simply by sitting together and talking about it. So the violent option is not there. Now, that, I think, works if the entire world looks like that. It doesn't work if there are parts in the world that do seek confrontation and that there are people who are ruthless. So when confronted with violence, how do you react? Many people in Europe, and I think some in America, have been deluded to think that such a confrontation is unnecessary. And all I'm saying is that that is not a product of reason. That is a product of, it is delusional. And I think it is, with all its ambiguities, reason is not to say that you can get so carried away with it, because once you get carried away, then you're no longer being reasonable. You're no longer being rational. So that's the only point that I want to make.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. The question is, where do we strike this balance? But I would go further, is that the other strange thing about the visceral code is that when it starts disintegrating, it's very hard to get back.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer Taylor, and I really enjoyed the discussion today. I do have a question that's largely directed towards Mr. Harris, but I would be grateful if Ms. Ali would also have some input. You talked about the sense of Iran's number of nuclear weapons versus Russia's and the sense of the rational actor aspect. But a lot of people, and for instance, I study a lot on terrorism, would believe that it's very rational what they've done. Not in the sense of a Western concept of being the intelligent thing to do, but in the sense of it going towards a purpose and succeeding at its goal. It certainly has brought about this war of ideas that they seem to be intending to do. And my question would be, when you were talking about the sense of anarchy and the crash of civilizations, is it really an anarchy in the sense of chaos when their whole purpose is to create a caliphate with fairly strict rules with the Sharia and the entire sense of the Islamic? I mean, there's very structured beliefs that go along. Now, obviously, there's multiple interpretations, but I'm just curious what your clarification would be on that.
Well, actually, there's a chapter in my book, I think, that's called The Logic of Fanaticism, which, going back to the ambiguity of reason, is that the way I see reason is something that's constantly expanding to try to understand more and more of what is irrational, okay? To us, terrorism, all that stuff seems irrational, but in my book I argue that, precisely your point, this isn't irrational. This is, in fact, it's not our idea of rationality, but it's a new form of rationality that makes absolutely perfect sense against us. And that you're quite correct that in the long run, the anarchy is, they don't simply want anarchy for anarchy's sake, but anarchy will do the trick. Okay, you don't have, it's like in World War II, we were up against the nation states that we knew that there was this final, that somebody could say, we surrender, okay? They don't have to do that here. They just simply have to get us to be so confused, so turned against ourselves, so incapable of reacting that, you know, we're no longer a power player in the world, in which the world is just everything is out of our control. As I say in the book, we're reaching a point, I think, now where the solutions to what's going on, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And everything we do is ad hoc. It's like, what do we do now? So policy, the whole idea of rational political policy depends on being able to predict what's going to happen. If we say, oh, we're going to start this, and they say, who cares? Then what? If we say, okay, we're going to invade your country, and the leader, like Saddam Hussein, says, well, who cares? What do you do? We're unable to. Policy requires a predictable world, and the world that we're facing is becoming more and more unpredictable every day. And therefore, rational politics and policy is becoming less and less a possibility.
Is there one final question?
I'm Clive Crook. I'm a writer with The Atlantic and The Financial Times. You emphasize, Lee, in your comments that liberal, tolerant societies are at a great disadvantage when they have to confront illiberal, intolerant ideologies. But you can't help but notice that in the 20th century, liberal, tolerant societies did overcome illiberal, intolerant ideologies. And it's interesting that we suspended many of our liberal ideas while we were engaged in that confrontation. I mean, there was massive suspension of civil liberties, and we were capable of awesome levels of violence against the enemy, let's not forget. I mean, certainly the golden rule wasn't much in evidence, right? We carpet-bombed civilians in Germany and Japan. We nuked Japan. We were capable of doing all that to prevail. I mean, put to one side the argument about how much of that was necessary to prevail. We thought it was necessary, and we did prevail. And our liberal societies were not destroyed as a result. You know, the liberal ideas survived. So I wonder about whether your main point isn't really our failure to recognize the danger. And I think there is a real issue about how much of a danger we now confront. My point would be, haven't liberal societies shown in the past that when they understand they are facing an existential threat, they are facing a potent enemy, they are capable of responding, I mean, almost one might say to a fault?
Well, in my book I point that out, and I say that just that what's called the greatest or finest generation was capable of doing stuff that we would be horrified to do. And my point, once again, it goes back to this idea of the visceral code, is that the question isn't whether we should do that. The question isn't whether liberal countries in the past have been able to do that. The question is, what can we do now? And my point is that we cannot do any of those things now. One of the first things that came out after 9/11 is re-invoking the past in which the Japanese had been Americans had been interred in California and other places on the Pacific coast. And it's like, well, we're not going to do that. Okay, well, you know, we can't do that. We all agreed with that. We all agree with the idea this is something we cannot do. But at the time, no one raised an issue about it in the United States. The Supreme Court approved it. The idea of Butcher Harris developed this technique of firebombing, and firebombing is a different technique. It's designed to kill people. Okay. Right. Okay. Well, sorry. Okay. But the idea, you know what I'm talking about, and it's like Goebbels in his diary says that the English newspapers yesterday said a million Berliners had been killed in bombing, and only 43 had. But the idea was that the London papers were quite happy to think that a million Germans had been killed in Berlin, civilians. Okay. We're not like that anymore. We're certainly.
Closer to what I suspect is your view than the standard liberal American view. I think this is we're a mortal danger, that's right. But that view is not widely shared. What I would say to you is imagine the situation after the next 9/11, or 9/11 multiplied by 10. Imagine dirty bombs in the US or a nuke in the US.
Well,
do you really think America would roll over in that situation?
Okay, look, this is the problem. I have an unfortunate habit of imagining just such things, okay? One of the things that I imagine happening is that, first of all, we will blame the administration, whoever's in the administration, and we'll get into this, who caused this and who overdid it, and we'll divide between those groups. The problem in the United States is that we have two political parties that were both originated in the 19th century, both of which are inescapable. Any leadership, anyone who's going to lead the United States is going to be either a Republican or a Democrat. They will have to be vetted by the entire process. Our leadership, if you're the next leader in Iran, may be the guy who cuts what's-his-name's head off, you know. But the next leader, the President of the United States, is going to be someone we know. And this is the same is true in England. There is this process by which leadership comes about. And no one who would be radical enough to act like Churchill is going to get near power. It was hard enough for Churchill to get near power. So, and I think that we're locked in this situation where we could not, even let's assume that the worst case, that we couldn't defend ourselves. So we literally would turn on each other, and instead of, where would a leader come from? Where would a leader come from?
Ayan?
I think one might think that I'm impossibly optimistic, but I think that we are in mortal danger. And I think we will react. And I think we have to make a distinction between attitudes and behavior. And also going back to the poll that you just gave about France, it is one thing for a Republican or a Democrat president to say, we are going to look into all the possibilities of a peaceful way out of this. But if that does not present itself, that attitude will be replaced eventually by behavior.
How?
Bill Clinton, when he was faced with bin Laden, after preaching forever that the only way of, and I don't think there's an American president who did more talking than he did, but when he thought that bin Laden was in Sudan, he bombed Sudan. He bombed Milosevic, or at least he persuaded, whatever, in his own way, to have the Europeans bomb him. After 9/11, there was a majority of Americans who all backed President Bush in going after whoever they were. And you get, after a disaster, you do get high numbers of people who support an active military intervention. So I'm not saying that we are not in mortal danger. I'm just saying that it's not, we are not hopeless either.
I hope we're not too.
I'd like to thank Lee Harris and Ayan Hirsi Ali for their really magnificent presentations. this morning. Thank you all for coming and for the many excellent comments and questions we had from around the world, from around the room. Most of all, I want to thank Lee for coming to AEI. Again, I hope he will come back soon, and I want to congratulate him on the publication of this superb book, which is available for purchase right now in the reception hall. We are adjourned.